This evening, we will be having something of a summary and a question, a dialogue session, I hope, concerning our study of being Baptist and just what it is for us to be Baptist and what makes us distinctive as such, and yet things that we have in common with others. As we begin, I would read from the Gospel according to Mark, chapter 9, verses 33 and following. Familiar passage, but it relates to some of our basic beliefs, or at least historic beliefs, as Baptists. Then they came to Capernaum, and when he was in the house, he asked them what they were arguing about on the way. But they were silent, for on the way they had argued with one another who was the greatest. He sat down, called the 12, and said to them, "Whoever wants to be first must be last of all and servant of all." When we began our study several weeks ago, we had the intention of looking at Baptist distinctives, Baptist history, and something of a challenge to truly Christian principles and to live by those principles that we share with most other Christians, though we have a distinctively interesting twist on some of those as Baptists. Our time has been far too short to really do a thorough study and a thorough reflection. Normally in the past, when I have done something on Baptist history and polity, we have spent an entire semester, 3 days a week, an hour at a time, dealing with Baptist history and Baptist polity and Baptist principles. But I hope that we have all gained something new, whether that has been new knowledge, new insights, or perhaps even a new appreciation of our Baptist heritage and our Baptist principles. But if we only gain new knowledge, new insight, and an appreciation of the principles simply to sit back and say, "You know, that was interesting and I gained some new knowledge. I discovered some new insights. I gained a new appreciation of our Baptist history and our Baptist principles. Isn't that wonderful?" And we fold our arms and sit there. Then it was never worth it. Because Baptist principles and Baptist theology and Baptist history demands that we, as Jesus said to his followers, be servants. Do something with that which we learn and which we know and which we experience. And so I hope that this last several weeks has also helped to lead us to a renewed commitment, or a new commitment to the diversity that is Baptist history and Baptist life, but also the unity and purpose that we find throughout our history, and actually throughout the entire history of the church. I want to move further this evening with two quotes. One of them is from Walter Rauschenbusch. Rauschenbusch we mentioned early on, and he has been called the father of the social gospel early last century. Rauschenbusch was a Baptist. And then a quote from former Yale University professor Kenneth Scott Latourette, also a Baptist. First, Rauschenbusch: "I should do harm if I gave Baptists the impression that we are the people and that there are no others. We are not a perfect denomination. We are capable of being just as narrow and small as anybody else. There are fine qualities in which other denominations even surpass us. I do not want to foster Baptist self-conceit, because thereby I would grieve the Spirit of Christ. I do not want to make Baptists shut themselves up in their little clamshells and be indifferent to the ocean outside of them. I am a Baptist, but I am more than a Baptist. All things are mine, whether Francis of Assisi or Luther or John Knox or Wesley. All are mine because I am Christ's. The old Adam is a strict denominationalist. The new Adam is a Christian, and sometimes a Baptist Christian. Rauschenbusch wrote that back in the 1920s. And that speaks to the Scripture passage, and really comes out of an understanding of the Scripture passage that I read a few moments ago, about the first being last and the last first, and those disciples had been arguing over who was the greatest among them, as well as who was the greatest, they or the scribes and the Pharisees and the Sadducees and the others. And Rauschenbusch warns us here as Baptists, I think, never to forget our heritage, one that was born in diversity and born out of an understanding of Christian freedom and Christian servanthood. To do so, we narrow ourselves and become strict denominationalists, and as such, we are the old Adam. But when we understand that we share so much in common with each other and with others as Christians, then even as Baptist Christians, we can be part of the new Adam in Christ. We need, I think, to remember as Baptists that while we have some distinguishing beliefs, we are a part of the larger Christian community. But unfortunately, and I agree here with a number of folks, including Bill Tuck and some others, unfortunately, many Baptists cannot articulate very well why they're Christians at all, much less why they're Baptists. I hope that after our study together, perhaps we can better articulate both. Why I am a Christian and why I am a Baptist Christian. Kenneth Scott Latourette was once asked by his colleagues at Yale University, which of course is not a Baptist institution, never was, why are you a Baptist? And this was his answer. I am a Baptist in part by inheritance, in part by inertia, and in part by conviction. Well, a lot of us are Baptists because we inherited our church. Our parents took us to a Baptist church when we were children, and we have simply continued on that path. Some of us are Baptists because of inertia, or really a lack of. We simply have not moved out of the Baptist church where we started. We're still within the familiar Baptist confines. But I would like to think that we could remain Baptist because we have some convictions that we understand and that have enabled us to understand our distinguishing beliefs. As we briefly review this evening, and I hope have some dialogue about where we have journeyed in this study, I hope that we will have a new conviction and a new commitment to understand our distinctives and to remain Baptist Christians together for life, not because of a lack of inertia, not because it's where I was brought by my parents, who were brought by their parents, who were brought by their parents, and I do know that there are some in this room who did not start out as Baptists, but who have chosen to be with us in ministry and to embrace those Christian principles that we share together, and specifically those Baptist principles that we share and hold dear. We began with some brief Baptist history to help us get some bearings on our origins, our initial beliefs, and our practices. We spoke of such persons as John Smith and Thomas Helwys, William Whitsett, and others. We looked at important moorings for Baptists, for us, such as the priesthood of all believers, Bible freedom, soul freedom, church freedom, voluntary association, and religious freedom or liberty, something for which Baptists fought and died in their early history, and for which some have fought even in our recent history, even to the death of some of their reputations in seminaries and churches and other places. We spoke of the responsibility that freedom demands. We can never talk about freedom legitimately. We can never talk about freedom if we fail to talk about responsibility and responsible action. To do so cheapens freedom, and it cheapens what God has to give us. We dealt at length on July the 2nd with religious freedom. Once again, speaking of Helwys and Leonard Busher, Roger Williams in this country, Isaac Backus, John Leland, and the contributions of early Baptists in America to religious freedom and tolerance. We also found some of this in the writings of Thomas Jefferson and John Adams and George Washington. In our third session, we talked about Baptists and worship, and in particular, the two major streams of Baptist tradition in worship. The Sandy Creek tradition from Western North Carolina and the Charleston tradition. We also spoke of the forms and the whys of worship, and that the Sandy Creek tradition tends to be more emotional, with a less educated clergy, and the Charleston tradition tends to be more highly educated with the clergy, and its approach is also along those lines. And interestingly enough, didn't say this the other week, but the Charleston tradition comes directly out of the first Baptist church begun in Providence, Rhode Island, by Roger Williams. The Puritans were more of the emotional side and very skeptical of educated persons, especially clergy. When Roger Williams left the Massachusetts Bay Colony and went and began or founded Rhode Island, and in particular Providence, and began a church there that was the first Baptist church in this country, among the things that you would find there were educated clergy and educated and learning laity. And folks left that church and moved, for jobs and other reasons, to Charleston. And the Baptist churches that they founded in the Charleston area were of that same type of tradition. The fourth session, we talked about our call to be servants, to discover who we are and what we need to know and believe, and then how we must act based on who we are and what we need to believe. Because once again, simply to ask the questions and to learn who we are and to learn what we believe, while it might be an interesting enterprise, the discussions, etc., it's not meant simply for that, but to make application in life. When Jesus studied and learned and continued to study and learn, not just as a child, but continuing throughout His ministry, and to dialogue with those others, it wasn't simply for the sake of the dialogue, though sometimes that can be very fun and very interesting. It can also be very dangerous. I used to regularly tell students, you know, I'd have some students sometimes, I can't believe that you said, well, nobody else was going to take the other position and argue it, and you need to know about it, so somebody had to. But it's not just for the sake of the discussion, it's for the sake of preparing to serve. We spoke of how public debates of the past how confessions of faith and local covenants were ways to not only state beliefs that distinguished the Baptists, but also served as challenges to serve. Speaking of all as ministers, not just the clergy. In fact, in many instances in Baptist history, clergy are to be those who help to prepare and challenge others to prepare, to minister, and to serve. Because as I have often said, there are places that you can go that either I can't, or if I do, the tone, the language, the jokes, the conversation changes. And in those situations, I don't make a difference. Well, I make a difference in the fact that they change until I leave the room. But I don't make the impact that you can make because you are co-workers or friends or participants in athletic competitions or other things with those folks. And preparation for ministry is as much a call of the laity as it is the vocational clergy. And then last week we talked about our call to be on mission, looking at the history of missions, a history which we share in particular with the Wesleyans and others, but a history that Baptists have been proud to claim. But unfortunately, much of that claiming that we're so proud of has been in merely giving the dollars to send somebody else where we don't want to go. And we looked at that history of missions, but we also talked about the preparation for missions that we have, missions in the local church, missions in the local community, and perhaps even missions around the world as we go and share with others who then share. We've also talked about the importance, and I've mentioned it two or three times already, but the importance of education, of learning all that we can, and of the ethics that become ingrained within us as preparatory for our overall mission in the world and to the world. We are not called to be out of the world. We live in the world. And we minister to the world. And we ended the session by talking about trends of a missional church. In other words, talking about us as we are participants in the mission of God to the entire world, beginning here and moving further and further out. In this study, we have learned things perhaps that we didn't know. Perhaps things that maybe even disturbed us in our comfortableness. But that's okay. That's okay. Perhaps we have even come to wonder and to question something of our own background or our own learning or from where we have come or to where we seem to be going. But then again, questions and doubts are not the mothers of unfaithfulness, but questions and doubts are the sisters of a growing and vibrant faith. And that is part of who we are as Baptists, raising those questions, seeking to learn, and seeking to serve together. That is our call. Serving together. Not just the professional clergy, but all of us. The first shall be last, and you shall be servants of all. That's part of the Christian heritage. But it has been historically, from the early days, part and parcel of the Baptist spin on Christianity. The times, they are a-changing. And sometimes we get caught up in being the old Adam. But I hope that our study, among other things, has challenged us to not jettison all of that, but to learn from it so that we, as the new creature that God intends for us to be, can help the world become the new Adams as well. And I use that as Adham, the generic term which is used in Genesis 1:28 and following, not Adhama, the man, that's used in Genesis 2. Not speaking just of men. I'm speaking of us, humanity. And particularly, we who are Baptists. In First Baptist. Or we who have thrown in our lot with First Baptist. Regardless of our denominational affiliation. But in heart, in spirit, in mind, and in service, we are together. So now, I've talked a lot over the last several weeks. I've rattled on and prattled on. And sometimes I've started at 10 minutes after 6, and at 7 o'clock we finally wind up. There have only been a couple of times that questions have been asked. Now it's your turn. I don't guarantee answers. I don't guarantee straight answers, but we'll talk about it. If you have questions or comments or observations, and for the sake of the video, I will attempt to repeat those so that they get through the microphone there, since I don't have a mic to hand out to everyone. Questions? Observations? Susan said that one of the things that she has appreciated, if I get this right, about being Baptist is learning to live with the questions and not always having the distinctive answers, but being able to live with those questions and learn through the possibilities and find the serving hand and the loving heart and the caringness that that goes along with that. No, we're never too old to learn, Doris. We're never too old to learn. Sometimes we think we are, especially when we're about 12 or 17 or 21 or 28 and we first walk down the aisle. Unless you become uncomfortable with what you're attempting to work on, you're not really learning. Educators know that. Sometimes we all need to be reminded. Some people have called our ability to think and to make decisions, our free will, to use that phrase, even though it carries all kinds of heavy baggage. Some people have called it the greatest curse that God ever gave us, because we end up making so many poor decisions in so much of our lives. However, others see it as the highest compliment that God has paid to us, to trust us in using those minds that He gave us with which to think and to ask questions and to seek, even though sometimes we make the wrong turn. Sometimes we seem to be asking the wrong question. Although sometimes I think it's not so much the wrong question as it is the timing of our question.
I think the paradox that you mentioned earlier about the first and last one intelligence is wider than the snow and earth shall be wrapped. The Bible is full of those kind of things that don't seem to be able to coexist. Impossible, and yet our religion makes it possible.
Right. That's the paradoxes in the Bible. The first being last, the blood washing us whiter than snow, those paradoxes allow us, our religion helps us to make some sense out of some of that and to live with it even when we can't make sense out of it, because there are times that we can't make sense out of those things or things that happen with us. There are times the Bible is full of all kinds of tensions. But then again, the world and our lives are full of all kinds of tensions with which we have to live. And you know, the Bible is not some nice, neat book tied up in a nice, neat bow and pretty wrapping and nice, pretty tissue paper on the inside and all that kind of stuff. I mean, if you really sit down and you look at it, the Bible is full of tension, and the Bible is full of not only the best, but the Bible is full of the worst of human life. Yes, Ariel. How important do I think denominations will be for our future generations? If you listen to my friend Dr. Bill Leonard from Wake Forest School of Divinity, he said that denominationalism is dying a slow death. And he said that Southern Baptist Convention, he said this over the last 20 years, the Southern Baptist Convention is the only living 19th century institution still in existence, because it's still living like the 19th century. That's his assessment, and his area is American Christianity. But a number of folks, not just Bill, but a number of church historians and scholars across the denominational spectrum, the various groups, have lamented and talked about the cafeteria style that the current generation seems to have. In some ways, they want a close spiritual or a deep spiritual relationship, but it's also, on the other side, the shallowness of me first. And if I don't like it, I'll shop around here, and if I don't like it, I'll shop around here, and if I don't like it... There's no commitment to denominational structures or even conventions anymore. And that has been going on probably for a while, but especially the last 15 years. 10 to 15 years. And denominational labels are becoming less and less important. There are, I will tell you, there are a number of churches out there that will show up and they'll explode in neighborhoods, and they are community type churches. But if you get to looking, they support, actually a lot of them that come out of and have support from, and they send support back to the SBC. But they don't put Baptist anywhere in the literature. They don't put Baptist anywhere on their sign. They don't even talk about Baptists because of the potential of turning folks off because of the denominational label. Which is kind of putting up a facade and not being completely out there. But and then there are folks, when they find out, oh well, this is part of this group, or there are also some that have that are aligned with certain other denominations, evangelical, such and such. And when people find out, once they've gotten in there, that it does have those ties to that particular denomination, a lot of them are kind of gradually pulling back and then starting to look around again. So I think denominational labels are less important to a lot of people these days, or they seem to be, for a lot of folks, they seem to be a drawback. I mean, there are churches that are Baptist churches and been Baptist churches all their lives, regardless of whether they're American Baptist, Southern Baptist, Cooperative Baptist, Missionary Baptist, or whatever, that have even taken put up new signs and dropped Baptist off the sign name. And some of that, I think, is because of some of the things that we have done in denominations, which has turned folks off. If you absolutely wiped out denominations, would the church exist? It might exist for about 15 minutes and then somebody would split off and start another group. I mean, seriously.
I know, but I'm not talking about that. I'm not talking about religion. Would the church, the Christian church, be able to survive without denominations? Would it be possible?
That depends on, I think, in part, and you know, others can chime in if you'd like, and that's perfectly fine. I think in part, if you could wipe out denominations and just have one church that called itself a Christian church worldwide, that would depend on leadership styles and those kinds of things, because actually that happened for a number of centuries. And then some folks decided, like Martin Luther and others, that what was being done by the hierarchical put you under the thumb and under the boot heel kind of approaches of what had developed into the medieval Roman Catholic Church was not really working and doing what it needed to do. And then you had the same thing in the Church of England that happened. And anytime, and one of the other dangers that happens is we see throughout history when the government and the church become too closely aligned, the church always suffers. Always suffers. In history. And the church, a lot of times, then becomes like the worst of the government instead of the better. So I think it would have to do with, the church might exist, but I don't think it would exist in peace for very long. Not in this world. I think it would just simply be a matter of time before the same kinds of things would occur. I mean, look at we who are in our history call ourselves Baptists. You know, we jokingly, but only halfway jokingly, say we multiply by dividing. That's why the United States government recognizes over 32 different Baptist conventions and denominations for tax purposes in the U.S. alone. So, I mean, that would be an ideal, but I don't know that it will happen in this world anytime soon. Messianic Jews, and how would they fit in? We do, but even what's really interesting is even within the Messianic Jewish movement, there are factions. It's not unified, and I think while there are some folks that are supporting and trying to push things. I really think a part of that is I read an article recently. Actually, my sister brought me an article that was, I may have shared it, some of it in here, that was in the Raleigh News and Disturber. News and Observer. That talked about there are a number of evangelical ministers, especially high-profile folks in this country, they're very much like the zealots that were determined to bring about the earthly political kingdom of God, whether God was ready for it or not. And that's why they went after the Romans and everybody else. These folks have said, we are going to do everything we can to bring about the rapture as soon as we can. To the point of sending money for arms for some of the Zionists and others. To the point of this one guy, and I think I did share this, this one guy who pastors a several thousand member church wears a yarmulke. That's a little skull cap, not the motorcycle. Wears a yarmulke on his head and a prayer shawl when he preaches. And his church now celebrates not just Christian holidays, but all the Jewish holidays. And he said, direct quote, I want everybody to know where we stand with the Jews, because when Jesus comes back, the only question that is going to matter at all is how you treated the Jews. I've been asking the wrong questions all my life, I guess. So, you know, I think that, you know, unfortunately, the thing is, most, if you look at them in their initial form, most religions in the world started out as peaceful movements. Not all, but most. And yet, more wars have been fought over religion than all other reasons combined in the history of humanity. So I don't know. I mean, we're supposed to be a movement that talks, and we do. We talk about peace and love and grace and forgiveness, and then we turn around. If you look even in church, the history of the Christian church, we've committed some of the worst atrocities on other humans that you can imagine. And some of those have been physical violence, and others have been emotional and spiritual and mean-spiritedness. So in answer to your question, I know that's kind of running around, but I'm not sure where all of that's going to shake out, at least while this world exists as it is. And I would much rather err on the side of grace and forgiveness and trying to find ways to unify our purpose and work together, even though we're different, than to do like some of these folks and say, well, I'm going to pick sides over here, because when Jesus comes back, the only question is how I treated the Jews. Or did I support the Messianic Jews? And which faction of that did I support? And yet, we as Baptists, if we hold to historic Baptist principles, we can have these kinds of talks and discussions, and we can agree or disagree and still go on and work for the kingdom of God. Now, there are some Baptists, many Baptists out there, who don't want to do that anymore. They've kind of forgotten Baptist history. And there are revisionists that are trying to rewrite it, much like probably 20 years or more ago. I was reading an article where history textbooks in Japan were being rewritten, and the attack on Pearl Harbor was a defensive maneuver against the aggressive Americans. And history textbooks had been rewritten for years in certain parts of Germany that Holocaust had never happened. It was simply something that was trumped up by Christians in other parts of the world, and by Jews in other parts of the world, and all this. But it was just a trumped up thing. And there are folks who are trying to rewrite Christian histories that way too. But then again, once again, I come back to the fact that our heritage, I think our heritage as Christians, period, but especially our heritage as Baptist Christians, is one that almost demands, in many ways, that we ask these questions and that we study these things and that we have to deal with questions, and sometimes we're going to be uncomfortable and sometimes we're not going to know the answers. But then again, a part of the reward is in the journey itself, not just in the final destination. Yes, George.
How can we, as Baptists today, speak to postmodernists?
How can we, as Baptists today, speak to postmodernists? Short answer is, there are many books out there, and some of them agree and some of them disagree, and you can get just as confused as anything. There are even folks who claim to be experts in postmodernism that are unfamiliar and confused. But the modern era, most of us in this room would be considered moderns. Logical thinking, scientific reasoning, those kinds of things, the modern era. Postmodernism, among other things, and chime in and add some things here, but postmodernism, among other things, are, I hate to use the term illogical thinkers, but logic doesn't necessarily matter that much in thinking and in searching. and there is less of a logical approach and more of a, I'm looking for a term, more, randomness and you know, less logic, less pattern, more randomness and more feeling. Than, you know, moderns have been accused, many moderns have been accused of being Spocks. Mr. Spock on Star Trek. You know, logic, reason, and sometimes cold.
1 + 1 = 2 this time as well as this time. For moderns, 1 + 1 = 2 this time, but it could be 4 this time.
Yeah. And 1 + 1 = 2 for moderns here, but then it could be 4 over here. You know, it's the rules of logic and all don't necessarily apply. But it's more than that. And moderns are typically more comfortable with structure and with institutions. Postmoderns, except for the 60s, postmoderns are less interested in structure, less interested in institutions, look for partnerships and partnering. Moderns, for moderns, you tend to partner with people who are at least in the same ballpark with you in thinking and reasoning and service. Postmodern mindset is more issue-oriented. And that's why, though, and once again, I have to go back because this is a major frame of reference for me in my history. When I was growing up, if in Burlington, North Carolina, if you knew somebody or if you went to school with somebody who was Catholic, that was an oddity. But you certainly didn't partner with them or have anything to do with them because they were Catholic and they were wrong. That thinking is wrong, but you know, that's I think, and that and a dollar gets you a drink, machine. But today, it is not uncommon to find on certain issues, such as abortion, to find Southern Baptists and Roman Catholics combining on resolutions against abortion or some other issue. And then when that fight is over with, they separate again and don't have anything to do with each other until the next hot button issue, and then they come back together again. And then when that's over, they go back. So how do we speak to the postmoderns? Very... Do what? No. And actually, if you really want to look at it, a lot of those things, Scientology and other New Age things, are just Gnosticism repackaged from way back when. But I think we have to find common areas where we can dialogue. I think that we have to, in addition to trying to understand the postmodern mindset and the fact that things don't have to be logical, and I mean they can be totally illogical and out of sync, which for moderns causes us to go haywire. But at the same time, I think it is incumbent upon us, however we do it, to also try to help postmoderns find a way to understand history and from where we come. And if it were not for that history and what we come from and our modern approach, they wouldn't have what they've got, or the approaches they do, or the freedom to do such. And I think we as Baptists have been in the forefront with that whole emphasis on freedom, though sometimes we back up and we pull in the reins at the same time, you know, because it's not to be unbridled freedom. You know, we have to recognize that there is freedom, but freedom also has limits. Even Paul writes that and says, don't use your freedom as license. A lot of folks do.
But I think we need to show, no matter the religion is, we need to show that person respect for them as a person.
Right.
We have respect for their feelings and their understanding.
Right.
We expect that of them for ours.
Yeah, we need to, and Ann was saying, we need to show, regardless of religion, culture, we need to show that person respect and understanding and respect as a person, because we would expect the same thing from them. And right, and understand that too. Yeah, understand their ideas. And there are people guilty on both sides. There are moderns and postmoderns both who are completely guilty of, I expect you to respect me, but I'm not going to respect you at all. I'm not going to have dialogue with you at all. I'm not going to try and learn from you at all. And I think we have to work on that. But it's give and take on both sides. And while a lot of postmoderns say they want relationships and deeper spirituality, they only want it, just like many moderns want it on their term, many postmoderns want it on their terms too. And dialogue and connection and spirituality has to be on their terms, or you're wrong and I'm not going to have anything to do with you. And that is the dilemma, that is the age-old dilemma, all the way back when folks first started disagreeing. We've somehow got to at least try to find ways to work together while understanding where the other ones come from, and not totally saying, you need to be in a padded room. That kind of thing.
But we need to realize that goes on within our small congregation.
Oh, it does.
As well as with another congregation.
Oh, it does. It goes on in all congregations. And it goes on. I know of a couple of larger, predominantly postmodern congregations right now that are having the same difficulties within their congregation. Even though they sprang up and grew quickly, now they're having some of the same kinds of things within theirs, because there's disagreement over all that kind of stuff too.
But if you go back to the Baptist principle that you were talking about, that's a wonderful paradigm for everyone. That obviously the things
you're
talking about, living those questions, loving the questions, no one has the answer.
Right.
So we work together, loving those questions, and trying to have the service oriented. What can I give? Not what do I get?
Right.
What am I contributing? Not what am I taking?
Right. And that whole thing of the dichotomy and living with the questions, and the Baptist principle of living with the questions, and even when we're uncomfortable with them, we continue to live with them, and all of those things, and the whole servant model. Not what can I get? What can I take? But what can I give? I won't quote a former president here, I think that's true, and I think there are many moderns and many postmoderns who are, that's, the mindset is, what do I get? I'm paying my money, what are you going to give me? And in the church, it's that way. That's why I mentioned the cafeteria style. You know, well, I'm going to buy this one, and then I'm going to buy this one, but if I didn't like that, I'm going to go back over here and buy this one. Yeah, that's that whole cafeteria mentality, and the mentality of, I'm in it more for what I'm going to get out of it than what I can give and share. And Jesus gave all. And Jesus said the first should be last and must be servant. Not servant of a few, but servant of all. The whole. If we were in the Middle East, what, as Christians, what do we do? Do we support Hezbollah? Do we go against Israel? Do we support Israel and go against Hezbollah? What do we do? How do we give? How do we take? How much longer do we have tonight? And even then, I don't know that we would solve that one. Because there are Christians that would take the side of Hezbollah, and there are Christians that do take the side of Hezbollah. And then we were driving home today, and I saw a church, a Baptist church, and on the sign in big letters it says, "We love Israel." And you know, so I think that's got to be an individual wrangling that we all have to go through as to why. And you know, I think, oh, you know, it's definitely, and you know, and oh, why not? We've got three of our own from here in those parts of the world that are fighting not just for freedom. They're actually fighting for peace. But the really sad thing is that the religious folks that are fighting each other over religion, in its basic form, both of those religions are about peace and helping your neighbor and loving your neighbor. Even Islam, there are places in the Quran you're supposed to. And even when you fight your enemies, in the teaching of Muhammad, if you're at war with somebody and your enemy whom you're going to fight the next day doesn't have a place to sleep that night or food to eat, according to Muslim teaching, you're supposed to provide a place for them to sleep and food for them to eat, even though you may fight with them tomorrow. It's something that I know we all think about on different levels a lot. It's something that I think about a lot, because we, as in our Judeo-Christian heritage, we talk about loving and caring and all of those things. That's part of our teaching. And hating what is evil and loving what is good. And then we turn around and sometimes in the church and sometimes out of the church, if it's not exactly what we think, we spit hatred and vitriol and all of that instead of love and instead of trying to understand. And I really think, George, back to your question, I really think that is the 64 billion to times 10 to the infinite power question as to how we find, or how we do that and get along and make the world better and make the church better. But you know, we as Baptists historically have taught that we ask the questions, we deal with the tough issues, and even if we don't come up with an answer, we live with that and we continue to find ways to work together and to work with others and to cooperate. Cooperative program was called A Rope of Sand, because that's how tenuous it could be. Grains of sand knocking against each other. Baptists as a whole have been that rope of sand. But I don't know. It's part of our heritage that has some good stuff in it. But sometimes the way we've turned it, it's been not so good. And I really wish I had more answers. But as many of you have discovered, I'm sure, the longer you live and you deal with the questions and you deal with life, even as a Christian, the less black and white, cut and dried there truly is. We'd like for it to be, and sometimes we pretend that it is cut and dry in the world, but it's not. We live in a gray, gray, gray world. And not just one shade of gray. different shades of gray. And it's hard, and I wish I had more answers. But I'll be honest with you here. If I had all the answers and I had the set and dried, cut and dried answers, I'd get bored and wouldn't do what to do. Well, that's yeah. That was Ken. Or half wouldn't agree and start another church. But I mean, I'm not always comfortable living with the questions, but I've accepted the fact that the only way I can grow and the only way I can learn and the only way I can ever hope to do anything that is worthwhile is to keep dealing with the questions even when I don't have answers. No, there's not. There's not. And I have something that someone sent me years ago. Talks about the perfect pastor. It's a long thing, but among the things is, he's 18 years old and he's got 25 years of experience in ministry, and those kinds of things. Well, I know we have gone for actually an hour since I got down here. Don't want to cut this off, but I know the choir needs to rehearse and other folks need to do some things. Perhaps we can continue this dialogue at other times in the future. I thank you for your participation. I thank you for your patience. And I hope that perhaps what we've done over the last several weeks has kind of spurred you to think some more about some things and deal with some things together, not just individually.